This is Billy Collins. I'm delighted to be on the podcast. The occasion is a brand new book of mine that's coming out any minute now. It's called Water, Water, with a comma in between the two waters. And it's just coming out from Random House, and I'm very excited about it.
Poet Billy Collins has an impressive resume. He served two terms as Poet Laureate of the United States and still teaches writing workshops and classes. In fact, I caught up with him outside of his hotel in Hawaii where he was teaching a workshop. His new poetry collection, Water Water, is like some of his other work for which he's beloved, like the poem The Lanyard, conversational in tone with humor sprinkled throughout, making it accessible for those unfamiliar with reading poetry, but also appealing to experienced poetry readers. I recently spoke with Billy Collins about his new collection. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Billy Collins. Would you mind reading one of your poems for us today?
Of course, I'd be happy to. The title of the poem is Against Longing. One of the things I would not write is, I wish I could fly away on silver wings, or I'd like to be a starfish on a sandy beach. Longing was once a big part of poetry, but now it's better to just say, you're flying, I'm flying, and don't sound overly surprised by it. Then you can describe all the things you find yourself flying over, another baseball diamond, that marina down there. And as for the nagging ambition to be a starfish lying on a sandy beach, just be one, lying there on a summer day, in the middle of a circle of little kids, all poking you with sticks, until some older kid comes along, picks you up, and launches you underhand in a huge arc back into the sea. Poof, you're a starfish. Also, you don't need that extra word sandy. Let the reader make the beach sandy in his head. Let him meet you partway. You can even picture your reader alone in a poorly lit public library, looking down at your poems, the way those kids look down at you on the beach, wondering how you were ever born and how you managed to get from place to place.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I think it's typical of a lot of the poems I write in that it starts, I mean, the context of it is giving advice to writers. It's kind of marking a change in the temperature of poetry away from, I would say, 19th century romantic longing. I wish I were a bird, you know, Shelley, wanting to be a skylark. And this is saying, well, just fast forward and you can just be a bird and stop longing about it. But the whole thing kind of backfires in that there are kids poking you with sticks and a bully throwing you back into the beach. So a lot of the poems are having a little thing on my mind and then just rolling with it through a series of associations, and I hope to end in a very rather strange place compared to where the poem begins. I guess a favorite metaphor line is that a poem, I like poems that begin in Kansas and end in Oz, go from a familiar place to an unusual place that the poet has actually created.
Perfectly appropriate for our listeners since we are in Kansas.
I forgot. All right. Well, it's Dorothy is a fairly common name, and it was back in those days, and Kansas would be thought of as a familiar place, common place.
I always try to conduct some pre-interview research, but I always seem to end up with the wrong number. Is Water Water your 10th collection of poetry, 11th? I saw a couple of different numbers.
I don't know. I'm in double figures, though.
Okay.
I think it's 11 or maybe even 12, depending if you count some early ones. But it's like my 8th book with Random House. So that's been a comfort to have a reliable publisher that is, so far anyway, is waiting for my next book. I don't know if anybody else in the world is waiting for my next book, but Random House is.
So what makes a collection? Are the poems selected by theme or style?
They just accumulate,
okay.
like cash in a diner. I write one at a time. You know how baseball or athletes say, we're just going to play one game at a time, as if there were any choice in the matter. So the poems are just written in individual acts. And then, I don't know, a year, year and a half, 2 years, at some point I think maybe there's enough for a book here. And I'll kind of gather them together, and it might come out to be, you know, 50 poems, and it doesn't look like a book yet. Just not hefty or anyway. There's a little baby bird coming within 2 feet of me here looking for a crumb. Yeah, I don't have an overarching theme. And so I never think I'm beginning a book with this poem and then another poem's going to fit in there. It's only when I rake them together in a pile that they become a book. And Robert Frost said that if you have a book of poems that's 59 pages, that the book itself is the 60th poem. So there's always that sense of the gestalt that the book itself becomes a poem. But of course, because every writer, every person has quirks and obsessions, there are identifiable themes. I mean, I, as in that last poem about a workshop, I have a lot of poems about writing, a lot of poems about teaching. And in Water, Water, I think maybe the difference between that and other books, it's become somewhat more autobiographical because I usually work with a persona, you know, a kind of speaking voice that represents me, but it's not exactly me. For instance, he doesn't have a job, or you never see him taking out the garbage or anything like that. He seems to be like a kind of I wish I were my persona. I wouldn't be working or anything. But there are poems in Water, Water, the new book, where I'm doing something. I mean, there's one where I'm at the racetrack with a friend of mine. There's one where I'm in, my wife and I are in Amsterdam, and we go to visit the shrine of Chet Baker, the site where he either jumped from or fell out of a window. The poem about going to see Percy Sledge at this roadside bar. So a lot of actual things I've been doing.
I want to throw one of your poems back at you and ask, how do you know that that bird was a baby? Because there's a poem where you question how old a crow is or how old a bird is. How can you tell? But I was also going to ask about the autobiographical nature of the poems, because the speaker will describe an idea coming to him while on a run or standing in a lake, and the speaker pens words on an envelope because he has no other paper nearby. Are you describing your writing process?
Well, yeah, because the writing process is, I'd say, sporadic. Unlike, I mean, a novelist, I picture a novelist going to the desk every morning, and the novelist follows Hemingway's advice. He or she picks up the novel where it left off the night before and putting in the hours, you know, maybe write 4 hours in the morning and that's it. But poems come at odd times. And when I recognize something that has potential, it's pretty much game on. In other words, I stop what I'm doing, even if it means pulling over to the side of the road, and I put my head down and write it out, you know, wherever it leads. So I don't have a process like I don't sit down at a desk every morning and write. It would be too much like going to an office to do something. So poems kind of fly in here and there. I mean, I was walking around the grounds of this hotel yesterday, and there was a nene bird. That's N-E-N-E, and that's the state bird of Hawaii. And I thought it was a statue because it was still, and then he moved his, or she moved the head. And then I thought there are a whole number of animals that for them stillness is their only means of defense, right? And there's actually a new book called, I think it's called Playing Possum, about how possums are the most dramatic example of an animal that actually plays dead in the hope that you will buy that and not try to eat it. So I'm in the middle of writing a little poem about people who use stillness as a defense, just blending in. And many of them don't go anywhere. I mean, some poems don't. The subject matter just doesn't seem to be cooperating. And the poem doesn't have any forward role to it because it's not going anywhere. And that just goes in the wastebasket. So there are false starts.
The title of this collection and the epigraph of the book are both from The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Why this poem?
Well, frankly, And this goes back to what I said about my books are not thematic in any way. Some books are caused by a death, and the whole book is sort of an elegy on that subject. But these are like cuts on a record, a disorganized record. So when I pick the title of the book, I really just go down the table of contents and find a title that I think would be interesting to see on the cover of a book. That quote from Coleridge. And I have another book with a comma in it called Picnic, comma, Lightning. And that's taken from Nabokov's Lolita, and Tom Stoppard called it the best parentheses in all of English literature. So I was quick to grab that before anybody else did as a book title. But I like the repetition of water, water. Not that it's the theme of the book, but it's a big topic, increasingly crucial topic these days, either the lack of water or the possibility of inundation. And I don't know if you can see the cover of the book. It's got a brown hare, mm-hmm. not a rabbit, but a hare racing along. And people from marketing were trying to connect it to the title. And usually I put cover art on the book that has really nothing to do with the title to create more interest. And they wanted to know, well, they called it a rabbit. Is the rabbit running? Is he thirsty? Is he looking for water? Or is he running away from the water? And I say, well, the only answer to that is both, you know, in poetry. You don't want to mean one thing at a time. And it's a poem in which this man likes to stand in lake water. And he does his best thinking there, for somehow it's inspiring. But, you know, he's an eccentric and fairly made-up speaker, having a made-up experience. And at the end of it, he does have these bad thoughts about the disappearance of water or the inundation. And they become the two basic psychological fears of engulfment or abandonment. And usually, just as people are born a guest or a host, most people have a predominant fear. They either are afraid of being engulfed and overwhelmed or abandoned. And then those bad thoughts lead to him thinking about inundation and drought. But he's almost like a climate change denier, because at the end of the poem, he says, it's so hard to think of those extreme states here in this pleasant lake up to my neck in lake water, when the trees are holding their position on the shore and the lake seems perfectly filled to the brim. I think that's the line where the poem ends. One of the things about my persona is he seems to be a lot less miserable than other people's personae. He's a person of contentment, or at least he's ready to be delighted. He walks around in a condition of readiness to be delighted. He's not ready to be offended or insulted or demeaned. Those possibilities don't occur to him. He's rather innocent in a way. He's not me. He drinks tea because he's very sensitive. And I drink coffee most of the time. And that's the key difference in our personalities. He's very sensitive.
Sometimes reading poetry can be intimidating, especially if you're new to it. You might not be sure of the cadence or the meter. Are there iambs? Do you read line by line or comma to comma? Do you continue through the enjambment? And sometimes the white space can feel suffocating. How should a first-time reader of Billy Collins' poetry approach this book?
Well, I think I'm a pretty, I'd say, hospitable poet. I write in sentences. The beginnings of my poems are almost always very clear. What you point out is a number of key elements in poetry. One is that a poem does not fill the page. The poem occupies part of the page, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of white space around it. Whereas prose is relentlessly filling the page, and it doesn't take a shape. You know, it's just page after page. A poem has a sculptural shape, physical look on the page. If you think of the white page, the blank page, as silence, because nothing has taken place on it. And then if you see the poem, like a sonnet in the middle of that page, you can think of the poem as a displacement of silence. It's creating a noise on the page, but it's in a discrete space, and it's surrounded by a kind of pond or a lake of silence. poetry can be challenging, but it's challenging most people who don't read poetry. Most of the people who say, I don't like poetry, are people who don't read poetry. And they don't like it, generally, because they had bad experiences in school with it. And poetry is one of the subjects that is one of the joys of life for me that is experienced largely in a classroom. When a person graduates from college or high school, I think they leave poetry behind along with trigonometry and some other stuff they'll never need in life. And they think of it as a school subject. For other people, it becomes a joy and a source of pleasure. And of course, you have to pick your poets. I don't read a lot of poets, and I stop reading a lot of poems. And I tell my writing students that your poem doesn't end at where you think it ends, with that flock of birds flying over the marsh there. It ends where I stop reading it. Hmm. You describe so many aspects of poetry, I'm going to stop now because you keep talking.
Well, you know, those who, you know, quote unquote, read your collection through the audiobook will hear the poems as you intended for them to be heard, because you narrate your own audiobook. Is that the case with all of your audiobooks?
Yes, I've recorded them all myself, yeah. Well, one thing you miss when you're audiobook with poetry that you don't miss with fiction is you don't get to see the poem. You don't get to see the look of the poem. And it's the same thing with the poetry. If you go to a poetry reading, you don't know what the poem looks like on the page. And as Philip Larkin said, you don't know where the end is coming. If you have a book in your hand, right, especially a book of Billy Collins where the poems are basically on one or one and a half pages, you can see where the poem's going to end, you know. And you can make emotional preparations for that moment. It's like, here it is. It's coming in four lines. You can't predict that. You don't know where the poem is going to end in a poetry reading. You have to have patience with it.
Well, our listeners are going to know what I'm going to say, because I read your poem on the page while I listened to it. So I had the best of both worlds. They know that I do that all the time. I listen to a book while I read it. There was no way I was going to listen to your poetry without having it in front of me. So that's how I recommend you consume this.
That's the perfect way.
Yeah. There was a poem titled Interrupted by Gabby Hayes. Did you have to practice that impression?
I can do a little Gabby Hayes for you. What in tarnation? No, that came pretty, sadly enough, came pretty naturally.
Okay, I'm usually wrong about this, but I thought I detected a couple of themes in the book. In Obod, I noticed like three oranges in a bowl. And then in Zero Grannies, I saw three lemons doing nothing in a bowl. And I wondered about still life. And then you have a poem titled Still Life with Fire Engines, and then one later called Drawing a Pineapple. Am I wrong again? Is still life part of this theme?
You're very observant. Oranges in a Bowl, it's been in many poems, and it's just an example of a kind of a Buddhist-type calmness. And I think it's one reason I really enjoy still life painting. And I've taken painting lessons, and I do a lot of drawing. I've taken drawing classes. And it's good for me as a verbal person who's, you know, talking at classrooms and then reading and writing to have a nonverbal activity where you're just drawing something in a bowl. But you're right. It's a kind of combination of my love of still life painting and my sense of the bowl with three lemons, usually an odd number. Like, you know, Japanese flower arrangements tend to be odd numbers. And, that's good. I forget what the other thing you noticed. Yeah, drawing a pineapple kind of combines the drawing part and the fruit part. But it's an image of serenity for me. A few pieces of fruit in a bowl. It's just this image of serenity and stillness.
You mentioned earlier the poem While in Amsterdam. And in that poem, the speaker describes his personal jazz hell as an all-violin band. And I have a video on my phone that my daughter recorded more than 10 years ago. She was in high school preparing for a violin recital, but it included all ages and skill levels. And all of the students were supposed to be practicing their pieces backstage pizzicato with no bows on strings. Yet the young, like first and second graders, were just full out playing. And in this video, my daughter is staring at her phone, at the camera on her phone, just, you know, blank expression, while this cacophony of out of tune, out of time screeches fill the recording. And she wrote these words across the screen: "What I imagine hell sounds like." Now, this was just one instance where I saw a reflection of my life in your art. Is this something that you want for readers of your poetry, that they see something of themselves in your work? Or what do you hope readers will take away from your work?
Well, that's an unusually literal connection.
I know, right?
With your daughter experiencing a violin or string hell. Well, there are those connections. And I try to start a poem by ringing some common note that everyone will understand or get. And maybe Amsterdam, maybe Chet Baker, that maybe a reader doesn't know who Chet Baker is, or that he died falling out a window in Amsterdam, but there's a little plaque there. I try not to make any factual things demanding. I try to stay within the compass of common knowledge in the beginning, because the poem is going to go somewhere, I hope, and find itself and leave the reader in a rather unusual place where you can't look that up. You know, you can't Google it up, as they say in the South. It's just an odd place that I've created for you to land. But there must be coincidences. I mean, there's a poem about Adam and Eve in here, and you know, someone might have been reading Genesis the other day before I read the poem. But that's very interesting. I wish I could see that picture of your daughter.
I'm actually going to send it to you. I thought about sending it a couple of days ago.
Oh, great. That's okay. Excellent. Well, I used to play in a high school band. I played trumpet in a marching band. And this was, I was born and raised in New York City. And we'd march in the St. Patrick's Day Parade on Fifth Avenue. And sometimes it would be really cold. But even when it wouldn't, in a high school band, you know, you're lucky if you're hitting every third note. You know, and every note's being hit, played by somebody, but it's rare that the same note is being played by everybody. So there's this kind of blat, blat. You know? So I kind of know what she means in a brass instrument version of her strings.
I played trumpet in high school as well, and I was really hoping during the Star Spangled Banner somebody else was going to hit that high note, because I wasn't going to get there.
Well, if you have a trumpet section of 12 people, it's pretty easy to fake it. Yeah.
Well, we have talked about a lot. Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked?
That's always a good question. No, I think what we've talked about, and thank you for guiding the conversation in that direction, is we've talked about the poetry as poems. We haven't talked about, you know, a theme of grief, or how people can find consolation in the poems. I'm really think of myself as a poet, yes, but also I don't balk at the title, you know, a verbal entertainer. I think the poems are little journeys, travels, as I said, from a common and ordinary place to an unusual, imaginative place. And when I'm writing a poem, I'm trying to push the poem around and in different directions to find that place to land, a place of settlement where at the end I don't want to say anymore and you don't want to hear anymore.
Well, the collection is Water, Water. Billy Collins, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's fun to talk to you. Thanks. Say hi to your daughter for me.
Okay, I will.
Okay.
That was Billy Collins, author of the book Water, Water, which was published by Random House. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.